Genesis 45. We are toward the latter stages of our study in the life of Joseph. Joseph is a young man that has learned through hard times to trust God and be used of Him. And there are so many parallels in our own lives and experience that we can learn from. At Genesis 45, we've come to the place Joseph had been hated by his brothers, sold into slavery. He went into Egypt. The Lord raised him up to a place of prominence to where he was the prime minister of the most powerful nation in the world through the revelation of God and the wisdom that God gave him. He managed all the assets of the land during times of famine, and now his brothers have come before him. They do not know that this is Joseph, and he is about to reveal himself to them. And so there are things that we can learn about coming close and finding out that we belong. Beginning with verse 1, and we'll read this entire chapter together. Then Joseph could no longer control himself before all of his attendants, and he cried out, "Have everyone leave my presence." So there was no one with Joseph when he made himself known to his brothers. And he wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard him, and Pharaoh's house heard about him. Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph." Now, this is the first time that Joseph has spoken to them in Hebrew. Every time up until now when he has spoken in Egyptian because he's hiding his identity. And so he has spoken through an interpreter to them until this now. But at this point he says in Hebrew, "I am Joseph. Is my father still living?" But his brothers were not able to answer him because they were terrified at his presence. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "Come close to me." And when they had done so, he said, "I am your brother Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed. Do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me here ahead of you. For 2 years now there has been famine in the land, and for the next 5 years there will not be plowing or reaping. But God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So then, it was not you who sent me here, but God. He made me father to Pharaoh, lord of this entire household, and ruler of all Egypt. Now, hurry back to my father and say to him, 'This is what your son Joseph says. God has made me lord of Egypt. Come down to me. Don't delay. You shall live in the region of Goshen and be near me, you, your children and grandchildren, your flocks and herds, and all that you have. And I will provide for you there, because 5 years of famine are still to come. Otherwise, you and your household will all, and all who belong to you will become destitute. You can see for yourselves, and so can my brother Benjamin, that it is really I who am speaking to you. Tell my father about all the honor accorded me in Egypt and about everything that you have seen, and bring my father down here quickly.' Then he threw his arms around his brother Benjamin and wept. Benjamin embraced him weeping." You remember now, Benjamin is his only brother by his mother. The others are half-brothers. So there's a special attention here. "And he kissed all of his brothers and wept over them, and afterward his brothers talked with him. And when the news reached Pharaoh's palace that Joseph's brothers had come, Pharaoh and all of his officials were pleased. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, 'Tell your brothers, do this. Load your animals and return to the land of Canaan, and bring your father and your families back to me, and I will give you the best of the land of Egypt, and you can enjoy the fat of the land. You are also directed to tell them, do this. Take some carts, that is some wagons, from Egypt for your children and your wives, and get your father and come. Never mind about your belongings, because the best of all of Egypt will be yours.' So the sons of Israel did this. Joseph gave them carts as Pharaoh had commanded, and he also gave them provisions for the journey. To each of them he gave new clothing, but to Benjamin he gave 300 shekels of silver and 5 sets of clothes. And this is what he sent to his father: 10 donkeys laden with the best things of Egypt, and 10 female donkeys loaded with grain and bread and other provisions for his journey. Then he sent his brothers away, and as they were leaving, he said to them, "Don't quarrel on the way." So they went out of Egypt and came to their father Jacob in the land of Canaan. They told him, Joseph is still alive. In fact, he is the ruler of all of Egypt. Jacob was stunned. He did not believe them. But when they told him everything that Joseph had said to them, and when they saw the carts Joseph had sent to carry him back, the spirit of their father Jacob was revived, and Israel said, "I am convinced my son Joseph is still alive. I will go and see him before I die." Every one of us has experienced times when we wonder, where is God and what is he doing? Sometimes God is so evident, so obvious in our lives, his presence, his working, everything can be easily told. At other times, it seems like he's nowhere near. And during these times, we can become very easily discouraged unless we understand something about how God works. When you examine your own life, where is God? What is he doing in your life today? Is he close and active and alive in your life, or distant and silent and long time missing? When we look at the life of Joseph, there are giant lessons to learn, particularly in how God works. God's promise to bless all the people of the earth through Abraham was going to take place through and involve Jacob's 12 sons, who were going to be formed into the core of a new nation. It was through this new nation that God was going to work. It was ultimately through this new nation that Jesus Christ would be born. Jacob had experienced the presence of God in his life. You remember on one occasion he wrestled with the angel of the Lord all night long. He said, "I'll not let you go until you bless me." He had experienced God in his life, but he'd done almost nothing, it seems, to introduce God to his 12 boys. When we get so busy that we don't do the things that the Lord really wants us to do, he'll use somebody else. God will do whatever he intends to do in his way, in his time, and if we want to be used, great. And if we don't, we can sit on the sideline. Well, God stepped in and selected Joseph, the next to the youngest boy, and it was through him that God was going to shape and bring this family into the kind of place that it needed to be if he was going to use it. Well, of course, Joseph thought this was wonderful. I mean, he was a teenage kid, and he's getting these dreams that says, look at the wonderful things that's going to happen to you. And his brothers, of course, didn't look so kindly on it. They hated him for it, and in fact, they then sold him into slavery. One of the things in this particular incident that is so helpful to us is the way that God chooses to work. And that is, he chooses to work actively in the lives of his brothers without them ever having any proof of his presence. In other words, God is working, and there's no over evidence, just a demonstration of what he's doing. And we frequently are in that place. We're not sure what God's doing, but we need to be able to trust him without any kind of overt evidence. Not only that, so of course what he did with these boys, because of their own guilt, he made them constantly wrestle with the consequences of the behavior, and then he constantly faced them up with who they were, coming back to them and back to them with, "Who are you? Take a good look at yourself." On the human side, he chose to use Joseph in their lives And they didn't know that Joseph was being used. Again, God is working, and there's no outward evidence of what they did not know that Joseph was Joseph. They just knew he was this austere, demanding, powerful, intimidating Egyptian. And so we're able to see, get a ringside seat on God working in the lives of people who don't have proof and demonstrations that he is there except the faithful working of what he's doing. Now, God greatly desires to relate to us on a personal level. He wants to have the kind of relationship where we're open with him and we tell him very openly what's going on in our lives, what our needs are, what our heartaches are. He wants that. He also wants to be open with us where he demonstrates his character. He leads us and we know that he's speaking to us and we obey him and we respond to him and we trust him. That's the kind of relationship that he wants. The question is, how do you get this close relationship? Particularly if you're in a position where God seems to be far off. I mean, we don't want him to be so distant, so mysterious. One of the things that's helpful if God seems far off from you is to realize he didn't move away. You did. As a matter of fact, when you move away, he moves close. You move away, he moves close. See, he really cares. He is a seeking God. He's not hiding himself. He's seeking. So how do we move closer? What does it take? Well, part of it depends on how far away you've gotten and how many things you've gotten in between you and God. So how he does this may be quite different with each of us because he has to deal with the obstacles that are there. In Genesis 45, we find Joseph and his brothers standing face to face at a time when Joseph is ready to reveal himself to his brothers. He's ready to take brothers who have been distant for 22 years and come close to them and have a relationship where they can really talk with one another and share. So we have, again, kind of a ringside seat in which we can understand how God works in this situation. When we're distant and God wants to turn our lives around, it is not a simple, easy, quick thing. One of the most dominant traits of all human beings is that we like easy, quick solutions to difficult problems. The more difficult they are, the quicker and easier we want the solution to be. Now, God is loving and God is compassionate and he cares about the difficulties that we face and the dilemmas that we're in. But the tangled problems that we are facing frequently are the result of some twisted living that's going on. Some twisted thinking that's taking place. And so God has to begin to change that. He's most concerned about the twists that are in our lives. We want God to change our situation. He wants to change our lives. We pray and plead to God, give us a new start. He says, I'll give you a new life. There's a whole difference in the concept of what God wants to do in our lives than what we ask for. So how does God turn our lives around? As we look at these passages where he's dealing with Joseph's brothers, there are several steps that he takes. And the first one is awakening to the problem and being convinced of a need. As long as we are able to define our own problems and define it in such a way that we can handle it, we don't need God. And left to ourselves, we will always define our problem in such a way as that we can handle it. And so we shut God out. Now, the 10 brothers had been doing that, and so the first thing that had to happen was they had to discover that their way wasn't going to work. Whatever they were doing wasn't working. For instance, they were angry with their dad, and they were angry with this special son of his, the favorite. Well, I think they had a right to be angry. I don't think Jacob ought to pick one boy out of the 12, and he is the precious guy. And he did it, and I think he did a terrible job. And they had a right to feel angry about that. The question is, how did they define the problem? And they defined it in a way that they could solve it, and their solution was, let's bring some hurt. Let's bring some pain. Let's teach him a lesson. So, they told the kid, just get him out of the way. This will teach the dad too. Now the interesting thing is, God let them play out their anger. Remember now, God has got to bring these guys who are a bunch of scumbags, and he's got to bring them to the place where they're going to be the leaders of a nation. They're going to be the leaders of the 12 tribes of Israel. So he's got to do some major work in their life. And he lets them play out their anger and their wrong way of doing it. That sounds fine, but Joseph was going to get caught in this. I mean, you know, it's fine for God to say, God can just let you be as mean as you want to, but what if you're going to be mean to me? Don't worry. God's in control of things. See, he has a plan for Joseph, and he has a plan for them. He's working this whole thing together. He knows exactly what he's doing. He let them play out their anger, but they did it under his supervision. They could only go as far as he would let them. What they found was that inflicting pain and misery only meant that they were going to share it. They were going to live every day for the next 22 years watching their dad in terrible misery, in anxiety, in awful pain about the loss of his son. They weren't going to be able to forget what they had done. It wasn't as if, well, we'll teach him a lesson, we'll go marry them. No, they were going to live with that. Not only that, but the secrecy and deception by which they did this did not allow them to deal with their guilt. They couldn't get it out on the table and deal with their guilt and get forgiveness and let it go. So they painted themselves into a corner that they were going to be stuck with it, and they were stuck with it for 20 years, 22. The second step is that God frequently brings us to a place of confession by bringing us to a place of desperation. We don't like confession, and we only do it when we have to, and that's desperation. In this case, there was a famine. The famine was a natural disaster, but it had supernatural implications. This famine was tailor-made and designed exactly for this purpose. The severity of the famine turned a normal style of life into something that was a series of movements of desperation. I mean, what do you do when you're starving? What do you do when you're dealing with this kind of thing? So the status quo was totally shaken up, destroyed, and they were, for the first time, ready to hear something that they had not heard. Their ears were going to be able to hear and pick up messages that they were not wanting to think about before. Every move that involved Egypt, every interaction that involved Joseph, was designed to face them up with some aspect of their guilt. Since they had sent Joseph off to Egypt, they did not want to think about Egypt, they did not want to think about Joseph, and God kept confronting them and using both Egypt and Joseph in their lives. He not only wanted them to look at their guilt, but he wanted them to look at the weakness of their own character. You see, forgiveness can remove guilt. It doesn't change character. Getting forgiven doesn't change your character. It just takes away the guilt. At every step, what Joseph was looking for, each time he gave them a test, he was looking to see, has God been working in their lives to change their character? And then he'd give them another test. See, is God changing these men's life? Is character changing? He could forgive them. He had forgiven them. God had to change their character. And God is interested in this. See, God is committed to transforming our character, not just forgiving our sins, not just getting us to heaven. See, his goal is to make us like Jesus Christ. He says, I have predestined that you would be conformed to the image of my son. That is his plan. That is his purpose. And so if he was going to use these boys, there was going to have to be some drastic changes. And the third step was, excuse me, the change has to start on the inside. and then show itself outwardly. When we see a change in a person, when we see a change in ourselves, we're not necessarily sure of exactly how deep that change runs. I mean, is this change for convenience? Is this change to appease? What's going on here? He had seen some evidence of genuine change in his brother's life. And the question was, how deep does it run? How much of this is really them now? Well, the final test that he gave them was, they'd come back to Egypt. He had been holding one of the brothers in prison until they brought his youngest brother because he wanted to see him. And then he says, this is great. And he sends all of them home, loaded down with food for the family and everything. And they were leaving out of the gates of Egypt just thrilled. They were going home victorious. What a tremendous sense of pride and accomplishment. They were going back with Benjamin, whom they had promised their dad would be saved. They had rescued Simeon from the prison, and now they were going back with food. Everything was wonderful. And then the bottom fell out. Then everything that seemed to be okay wasn't okay. Because they were pursued, they were accused, and they were indicted for theft. Someone had stolen Joseph's silver cup, and it had been placed in the bag of Benjamin, the youngest. Everything that they had been rejoicing over now vanished. The path back to Joseph's house was fairly short, but it was long this day, full of anguish, full of heartache. The sun that was shining when they left was still shining. I've got some water coming here. There you go. The sun that was shining while they left was still shining. Thank you very much. But in fact, their whole world had turned dark. Everything that seemed to be bright now vanished. And the despair that they faced of going back one more time and pleading innocence was almost too much. Because, see, they had been pleading innocence ever since they had met Joseph. And they were guilty of sin. And now they were going to go back one more time and plead innocence. And they knew they were wrong. And it gets a little bit old saying that everything's okay when you know in your heart it's not. So here's this austere governor, this prime minister, this powerful man who has the power of life and death. Why should we unearth a crime that's 22 years old and tell him about it when he doesn't know or care? But they didn't have much choice because God wasn't going to let them go. God kept bringing it back to them. And so their first words, when Judah spoke to Joseph, his first words were this. He put it together for the first time. What can we say? How can we prove our innocence? God has uncovered your servant's guilt. We didn't take the cup, but there's no use saying innocent. There's no use trying to prove it. We are guilty. And God has said it, and God has shown us, and there's nothing we can do about it. In spite of the fact that we didn't take the cup. He just came clean. Didn't go to all the details, but he already knew the details. And then, of course, following that, Judah came with a plea that's astonishing to read. It's wonderful, almost poetic. And it demonstrates change to the most basic level of his life. The kind of compassion, the kind of concern, the kind of openness, and the willingness to put himself on the line. And at this point, Joseph knew that God had done a great work. Joseph knew that God had begun to change these guys' lives, and Joseph knew that it was now time, and they were able, for the first time, to put this family back together. You know, in fact, this family had never really been put together. It had always been in shambles. And so for the first time, there was going to be union and unity in this family. Now, when we see the situation where they're standing before Joseph, and he's getting ready to give them his blessing and forgiveness, you see a tremendous sense of trauma. Sometimes we think of forgiveness in such a shallow way that we do not realize the trauma that's involved in forgiveness. But it is. The idea of forgiveness is basically foreign to the human thinking. We're so filled with pride, we're so filled with an inherent longing to be worthy of everything that we desire and everything that we've done, that it's very hard for us to talk about needing forgiveness. We want to be worthy. We want to be right. We want to be okay. We don't want to say, I'm wrong and I need forgiveness. So it makes it very difficult for us to accept forgiveness and sometimes to even believe that it's possible. In turn, until we have genuinely experienced forgiveness, either from God or from someone who reflects the forgiveness of God in their lives, until we've experienced that, it's very hard for us to forgive. If you're hurting, you tend to hurt. If you're unforgiven, you tend not to forgive. So we have here Joseph and these boys, and in Joseph, you see the picture of the person who is doing the forgiving when he's been hurt. Joseph had been hurt. I mean, everything that was necessary to hurt a person, he had gotten. But if he was going to forgive, if it was going to come out, it had to be important for him to want to restore the relationship. Joseph had lost a loving relationship with his dad. He had lost a valuable relationship with his younger brother, and it was important for him to restore those. But he had lost a relationship with 10 brothers that never really existed. He never really had a relationship with them. Nothing to brag about. Nothing to desire. It was always one way. But he wanted to restore a relationship that he didn't have. He wanted to have that. Sometimes when people hurt us, we don't want the relationship back. We don't want to restore it. But that's not Christian. If you forgive, you immediately restore the relationship, right? What have you done? Joseph didn't do it that way. Joseph said, I've forgiven them, but I want to see if God's changed their life. I want to see if their character has changed. You see, you forgive someone, or someone forgives you, and you jump right back in the relationship, you're right in the same destructive mode that you were before. Nothing has changed. And it's going to continue to be destructive because the character hasn't changed. So we have, in our Christian circles, defined forgiveness and restoration as what? No, restoration is a process. And the process involves change of character. Forgiveness is immediate and complete. Restoration is not. And so Joseph did not immediately restore. In fact, he tested them. And he watched to see if there was change. And he tested them. And he watched. And he tested them over and over until he was convinced God was working in their lives. There was change of character. Then it was time for restoration. Now, it's important not only to desire to restore the relationship, that's always the ultimate, but the immediate is for them to have a relationship with God. See, that's what's really important, because if the person that we've forgiven has a relationship with God, then it means pretty soon we're going to have a relationship with one another, because God can change us, and he can change the other person and bring us into a place of real harmony. Joseph had developed a relationship with God. He knew what it meant. And he shows this when he meets them. The first thing he tells them is, God sent me here. God made me father to Pharaoh, lord over the entire household, ruler of all of Egypt. Do you see what God is doing in my life? You see how important that is? I want you to know about my relationship with God. Who is very vital to him. The other thing we see in this incident is, for Joseph, forgiveness involves every part of his being. For some of us, forgiveness just goes right here. And the fact is, it's probably not much forgiveness. Forgiveness involves every part of him, so that when he realized that he was able now to actually reach out to the guys, he was so near losing control that he ordered everybody out of the room, all of his servants, all of the Egyptians. This was a family matter. This was very personal. He didn't want them involved. They wouldn't understand. It was none of their business. This was very personal. So they go out, and he breaks into tears in an explosive kind of weeping. A weeping that comes all the way from the inside. It involves every part of his being. It's so loud, everyone hears it, but nobody knows what it means. The brothers see it, and they are petrified. They do not know what is happening to this powerful, austere man who's standing there, who's bursting into tears. What in the world does this mean? Are they in danger? The servants who had gone from the room were able to hear it. They didn't know what it means. That meant they were alarmed, and they ran to tell Pharaoh. Something terrible's happened. But Joseph was not just now forgiving his brothers. Joseph had already forgiven this a long time before. You see, he had to. He had a relationship with God who was forgiving. In order to maintain a relationship with God, he had to forgive them. He hadn't revealed the forgiveness. He hadn't started to build a relationship back with them, but they were forgiven. See, Joseph had intuitively learned what we read in the New Testament, that it is impossible to receive the forgiveness and the grace of God without being obligated to forgive and show grace to others. Paul tells us, you forgive the way you've already been forgiven. If you've been forgiven completely, you forgive completely. You've got that responsibility. Well, Joseph had waited for this opportunity to act out the forgiveness, to tell about it. The fact is, Joseph had been afraid, and this is the reason for the explosion of the emotion. Joseph had been afraid that this was never going to take place. He really did not think those guys were going to change. I mean, this was too much to even dream about. He knew God working in his life. And he could only hope that that same power and grace of God could work in their life, but he wasn't very confident of it. So that the moment that he saw for sure that God had begun to transform their lives, he just exploded. I mean, all of it came, the dam broke, and everything came breaking through. A burst of joy, a tremendous release of tension. Now, here are the other guys. Now, they're standing there, and they are to be forgiven. They are receiving forgiveness. The question is, what do you do? How do you receive the forgiveness when all you've got to offer is your guilt? When we stand, we want to say, God, forgive me because I'm really a nice person. God, forgive me. I've got a real genuine heart. I'm real tender and caring. I messed up here, but please forgive me. I'm really usable in your hands. I'm really going to do good things. And we want to somehow bargain with God. And what he says is, just come tell me you're a jerk. Tell me that you've done it again and again and again. I mean, you know, you're not that wonderful a person. Just tell him, Lord, I'm a sinner. I did it again. How can you put up with me? You know, you are so gracious to even listen to me. Why am I taking your time? I want you to forgive me and I want you to change my life. That's what he wants to hear. We have a hard time with that. It's one thing, now, just put yourself in this, they've just gotten caught with a silver cup in the bag. It's one thing to be caught red-handed with incriminating evidence that is hard to answer. It's another thing to find yourself standing before a judge who has the power of life and death over you, and suddenly realize, when this judge was a boy, you sold him into slavery. And he knows it. And when they realize that, they tremble in their boots. I mean, you cannot get in a worse situation than that. When they looked into Joseph's face, they had no idea of the gentleness and love that was in his heart. All they knew was the stern voice and the demanding quality that he had showed them. The sound of the name of Joseph, when he said, "I am Joseph," sent shockwaves through their entire being, from the heart to the gut and back to the heart and back to the gut and to the toes and the head. Everywhere you can feel it. And their pale face and stony silence, frozen in terror. They could not and they would not ask him, "What did you say?" They're sure he did not say, "I'm Joseph." But it sounded like that. "So what do you say?" And then it got worse. If it could get worse, it got worse, because now he repeated his claim, "I am Joseph," and then he proved it by telling them the best kept secret in Canaan. "I am Joseph, whom you sold into slavery," and nobody knew that except them and Joseph. It had to be Joseph. He couldn't be lying. So they began to look and see his features, the Egyptian quality of his hair and dress and everything, and under that was that the 17-year-old kid that they threw in the pit and sold. Joseph knew them at their worst, and yet he forgave them. Nobody knew what scumbags they were like Joseph, and Joseph forgave. What a wonderful picture. God forgiving us. Nobody knows how lousy I am like God does. He knows it better than I do. He knows you better than you do. We have to gloss over a lot of stuff just to be able to look in the mirror every morning. He didn't gloss over any of it, but he forgives. He knows. And then Joseph asked them to come close to him. "What do you want us to come close to you for?" But he asked them to come. Now, he did not excuse them. He forgave them. If you excuse somebody, you can't forgive them, because you don't need forgiving if you can be excused. He never excused them, but he forgave them. And then he began to comfort them. He comforted them first by telling them about God's overriding plan that included all of this. It included their sin. It included his pain. It included everything. But God's overriding plan was bigger than all of us. This was a little too much for them to believe. It was too frightening for them to hear. But Joseph continued to give them comfort. And he did this instead of leaving them there to just be frightened and frozen. He just began to talk and tell them, "Here's what's going to happen. Here's what we're doing. Here's what we're going to plan. We're going to go and we're going to take stuff down. We're going to bring the family back. And we're going to live in Goshen. Everything's going to be taken care of. And he just began to talk to them in ways that would allow them to get some semblance of control of what's going on in their lives. And then he started with Benjamin. Benjamin would be the most responsive person to him. No barriers between him and Benjamin. And he goes and hugs Benjamin and kisses him and cries. And he turns and hugs each one of the brothers and tells them they love them. He's building the bridge that they could not build. God builds a bridge toward us. We cannot build toward him. All we can do is just say we're sinners. He's the one that says, "I love you. Come to me," and shows us his affection and shows all of his provision for us. What a wonderful picture of God's acceptance of us. When we deserve only the worst, he gives us only the best. That's what Joseph did. That's what the Lord does. Now, all of this is building up to one thing, and that was, there was a single truth that Joseph told them that made all of this possible. It is the thing, if you understand, that will allow you to deal with all the troubles of life, to cling to God and draw close to him. And Joseph pulled it down and put it in a few words. There are many ways that we can explain this from Scripture, but I'm just going to kind of follow through how Joseph unfolds it. As Joseph comforts them, he says to them, "Here is what I learned about God that allowed me to deal with all my troubles including forgiving you. And the first one was that God has a plan that's bigger than all of us and includes all the details of our lives. In verse 5, he says this, "Now do not be distressed, and do not be angry with yourselves for selling me, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. You did wrong, but he did right. You did it for the wrong reasons, he did it for the right reasons. You are guilty, but you don't need to beat yourself, because you've been forgiven, and God, you need to understand that God had his hand on this thing all the way through." You see, God's never surprised. God doesn't have any blind spots. Nothing sneaks up on him. No bad luck messes up his plan. See, he doesn't have bad luck. God does what he wants to do. God never causes the sinful actions of men, but he takes all the evil and the hostility of men, and he fits right into his plan and makes it work for him. So you look around and you say, wow, things are out of control. Things are out of our control. We don't know what's going on, but he does. And he takes even the sin of man and fits it into his plan so it works to his own honor and glory. Second thing is, God is always good and gracious to us in his plan. He really cares about us. He says in verse 7, "God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance." You sinned and God used it for you. How do you get more gracious than that? How do you get more love? Lord, I've messed up everything. He says, "That's okay, I can use it for you." He didn't use our best. How could he use our good, huh? I mean, we could really get things moving if we do things right. See, when we experience difficulty and pain, it's just so assuring to know that we're in the hand of a caring God. He really is in control. Paul says, "We know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love him and those called according to his purpose." All things don't naturally work together for good. All things naturally fall apart. He caused them to work together for good for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. The third thing is that he's able to overrule every power of man and cause it to work for him. He says in verse 8, "So then, it was not you who sent me here, but God, and he made me father to Pharaoh, lord of his entire household, and ruler over all of Egypt." This little country boy, this little shepherd from Canaan, becomes the most powerful man in the most powerful nation in the earth. How does that happen? God can do whatever he pleases. We need never be intimidated by the positions and power of men. Here's one that you will recognize but not like. And that is, problem people are often God's gift to shape our lives. We all have our share of problem people. Joseph had his 10 wonderful brothers that he had to deal with. He had the slave traders to deal with. He had Potiphar to deal with, and Potiphar's wonderful wife to deal with, not to mention the absent-minded cupbearer who couldn't remember to get him out of prison. He's dealing with a lot of problem people. Now, if these are gifts from God, these are frequently the kinds of gifts that we'd like to kind of return or get a refund on them. If you want to be able to view people that God brings into your life as his gifts, as part of his gracious goodness to shape our lives, if you want to be able to have the patience that is involved in that, all you have to really do is just realize what a pain in the neck you've been to God. You and I are problem people to God, and he hasn't taken us back to customer service yet. and he's not going to. When you recognize how gracious God is, it's just amazing. The last thing is that God will use whatever means necessary to bring about his purpose. Pharaoh himself jumped into the fray and eagerly became a participant in doing God's will. Do this, he says. Take some carts and wagons from Egypt for your children and your wives and get your father to come up, and never mind about your belongings, because the best of Egypt will be yours. God didn't have any problem with the powers that be. In fact, he had so indebted Pharaoh to Joseph that Pharaoh had basically no option. Here's the guy who had made him not filthy rich. He owned everything that was in Egypt. He owned the dirt, the cattle. He owned everything there, the people. Now, there's one little piece of unfinished business that they had that you and I also have. The one little piece of unfinished business, if God is actually going to bring union between us and folks that there's been hurt. You remember Joseph's last word to his brothers as they're going off in the distance. He sounds like Mom, and he says, "Don't quarrel on the way." Why did he say that? What were they going to fight about? How did he know they were going to quarrel? Well, you say, well, you know, he gave extra stuff to Benjamin and so they could... He did that, and he did that on purpose, just to kind of put a little extra something in there. But they'd really won that battle. They'd gotten over that, really. But he did that anyhow. But you remember, there was one last thing hanging. They were going to go back to Dad, and they were going to tell him Joseph was in Egypt. And how were they going to explain how Joseph got in Egypt? How were they going to tell Dad that they sold their brother as a slave 22 years ago and told him that an animal killed him and let his dad suffer all that time? How are they going to do that? It wasn't going to be easy. Maybe they could blame it all on Reuben. Maybe they could blame it all on Judah. Judah was the one that mentioned that. Maybe they could blame it on... What were they going to do? It occurred to me that they might not even have to mention a thing. They just go and say, "We went down to Egypt, and lo and behold, Joseph is there, and he's risen the great... I don't know how he got away from that stupid animal. But somehow he did it, and there it is. And so let's forget and go ahead and enjoy." There were two problems that they faced. One was, Benjamin now knew the secret, and Benjamin was going to be there, okay? And the second thing was, they were getting ready to take Dad up to meet Joseph, and they were going to talk. He's going to find out the truth. So how do you tell something like that? And the fact is, you just tell the truth. If you're ever in doubt about what to do, tell the truth. But the truth is just sometimes really hard to tell. Why not? Part of the problem is you have to tell the truth about you in order to tell the truth about what happened. I mean, you have to say, "Dad, you're not going to believe this. You have 10 of the worst boys that could ever walk on the top side of this earth. I mean, guys that you've trusted have not been worthy of any of your..." And Dad says, "Oh, come on, boys. No, Dad, you don't understand. This is bad. We are really, really bad. And you're going to believe it. You're not going to believe it when we tell you." And then just tell. Now, there is one other thing you can do, and that is the truth can be very brutal. You can tell someone the truth in a way that just crushes them and hurts them and destroys them. They could have walked up and said, here they come up to you and say, "Dad, by the way, we got something to tell you. We sold Joseph as a slave." He's dead, right there on the spot. I think probably what they did was they came and they said, "Joseph is alive," and they told him all the good things till he could finally let himself believe it and understand it and begin to rejoice in it and feel good about it and get ready to go to Egypt. And then they said, "Now, Dad, now that you got your feet on the ground and everything's okay, now we got some bad news." You have to be wise and gracious and loving and kind in your use of truth. You got to tell the truth. He's got to tell us in a way it's not destructive. Truth builds up. See, the truth binds us together, The truth sets us free. The truth encourages us. The truth strengthens us all at the same time. If you let the truth work in your life. And the one truth that Joseph said really pulled all this together for me is knowing God has things in His hand. He loves me. He's going to make things work. And whatever I'm dealing with and whether I see Him around and whether I know He's there or not, I just need to know that's the way it is. When you know that, you can look right beyond a whole lot of stuff because God's purpose is going to be fulfilled and it's going to be for your good. Let's bow heads in prayer.